the moment any sort of conflict spins up anywhere in the world, folks, hopefully it doesn't surprise any of our listeners, but there's always now a cyber component to it. The kinetic action is fairly predictable. The cyber component is the one that, you know, could be anything from taking lights out, shutting down power plants, to hacking, you know, the disruption attacks against partners, affiliates. I mean, all kinds of potential options here.
Welcome to the Cybersecurity Defenders Podcast Weekly Intel Chat. My name is Christopher Luft. I'm one of the co-founders of Lima Charlie, and I will be your host. Joining me today to break down the cybersecurity news being shared by the awesome InfoSec community is the one and only Matt Bromley. And don't forget, this podcast is brought to you by Lima Charlie, maker of the SecOps Cloud Platform, infrastructure for security operations. Think of it as a backend for your MSSP, where everything is built API first. Scale with ease and confidence as your business grows. You can start today for free at limacharlie.io. Now let's get into it. Mr. Bromley, we've done it. We have arrived. It is episode number 300 of the Cybersecurity Defenders Podcast.
Wow, we made it. Oh my goodness. I can't believe it. 300 of these. Man, that's awesome. It's actually really, really cool, Chris. Huge congratulations. You're the one that's actually been on every single episode since then. So congratulations to you, sir. I meant to get some champagne to pop on the air, but then I'm not sure the quality of Intel breakdown we're giving if we're also sipping a little bit of Dom on the side.
Yeah, so, I thought about that too, and I got a lot of stuff to do these days. So
yeah, we'll keep that for later. I'll ask AI to make a glass for me.
Yeah, maybe I can have one of those. I don't know why I'm drawing a blank here. The orange juice and champagne on Saturday.
Mimosa.
A mimosa for breakfast.
There we go. Celebration mimosa.
Yeah. All right. Lots of crazy stuff happening right now. And I'm really interested to talk about this first one because it's sort of this where this digital realm meets the real world and geopolitics and all that stuff where everything collides. So the Iranian drone strike damaged 3 Amazon Web Service data centers in the Middle East, highlighting the physical risks associated with large-scale cloud infrastructure. According to AWS, 2 facilities in the United Arab Emirates were directly struck, while the data center in Bahrain was damaged after a nearby drone impact. The attacks caused structural damage, disrupted power delivery systems. AWS also reported that fire suppression systems were triggered in some cases, which led to additional water damage inside the facilities. By late Tuesday, the company stated that recovery operations were underway and progress was being made at the affected UAE sites. Despite the physical damage, the operational impact appears to have been limited and localized, unlike previous AWS outages that were caused by software issues and resulted in widespread global service disruptions. The damage from these attacks did not significantly affect global operations. AWS provides backend infrastructure for a wide range of services used by governments, universities, and businesses worldwide, which I think we're all well aware of. As a precaution, the company advised customers operating workloads in the Middle East to migrate systems to other geographic regions and redirect traffic away from infrastructure located in the UAE and Bahrain. So that's wild. We're telling people to move their cloud infrastructure workloads geographically because of the kinetic stuff happening on the ground.
Yeah, I mean, Chris, I actually had a workshop I ran yesterday and, the day before we recorded this, obviously, and the workshop planning was done months in advance. And I simply started the workshop with, if we had done this thing a week earlier, the world looked very different than it does now. And sure enough, this is one of the things that's likely to come up in attacks that have been launched against Iran and various retaliatory attacks that have happened in the Middle East and the region and stuff. We're obviously going to come up on this episode today. So happy 300. Here we go. The world is at war again. But this is one of those situations where I think we often talk about like cyber warfare as a component, which means opposing militaries using cybersecurity or I should say, using cyber attacks as a vehicle, if you will, and things like that. But the flip side of it is, how about a disruption of infrastructure? And that appears to be what we're looking at here. This isn't, oh, there's a brand new piece of malware that's out and did a thing, or look at this crazy destructive whatever. It is data centers getting blown up as a retaliation to attacks that have happened. And the thing you got to like think about here, Chris, and not to make this a political discussion, but it's inherently going to be one. But the real question that I had when I read this for the first time was, did they get attacked because they were data centers in the region that were used for whatever, or did they get attacked because it's an American company? Mm-hmm. And that's the other kind of really, really tough component there is, you know, what was the targeting? I'm not going to say it was opportunistic. I think it was very targeted. Like there was a specific hotel in Dubai that got hit, I think for its affiliation to maybe America, you know, American transients and stuff like that. But the flip side of it is, it's falling into a real, real crazy, you know, just a scenario, a situation where you're an American company, you operate in the region. You know, what types of assets do you have on the ground, data centers that are running there and that kind of stuff? They become targets. Is it just to put a, like, you know, is it just to put an impact into the, you know, into the American company's operations? Is it because we know certain things and the opposing government knows certain things are hosted in those data centers? So it's actually more of a kind of red herring slash disruption style attack, right? I don't really care who owns a data center. That data center is going to get targeted and it just happens to be AWS. These are all things that go into these different calculations. And I find it to be fascinating is the wrong word, but we're going to see this increased type of cyber targeted warfare, meaning cyber assets or digital, you know, cloud centers, assets and stuff like that being targeted. And, yeah, it's just, I think this is not the first time we're going to see this. You know, it says at the bottom of the article, and I've got it kind of zoomed in here. Data centers run by AWS are massive facilities that are hard to hide and stuff like that. And I don't think that's lost on anyone. It's no secret that you're either looking at a data center, a distribution center, or a warehouse of some sort in a lot of parts of the world. I can tell you here in the States, when you drive past an Amazon distribution center, there is no doubt about what that thing is. You look at it from above, and it's clearly a distribution center of some capacity, right? And I think where this article is leaning towards and some of the stuff that's important to note is they're built for redundancy and uptime. But what I don't know, Chris, is I don't know if they're built to withstand intentional like missile attacks and stuff. And that might be another kind of threat model that comes out of this conflict. It might be, I can't call it a war, but it's another thing that might have come out of this conflict.
Yeah. So for those listeners that might not be aware, AWS infrastructure is organized into geographic regions that contain multiple availability zones. The company reports operating data center clusters in 39 regions globally, including 3 in the Middle East, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Israel. Each region contains at least 3 availability zones, which are physically separated facilities, typically located within about 100 kilometers of one another. These zones are connected through ultra-low latency networking to support rapid data transfer and enable failover between facilities. The architecture is designed so that the failure of a single data center generally has minimal operational impact because workloads can be shifted to other zones. However, experts note that simultaneous damage to multiple facilities within the same availability zone or region could create capacity constraints. Mike Chappell, an IT professor at the University of Notre Dame's Mendoza College of Business, explained that AWS systems are typically configured so that losing a single data center is relatively manageable. If several facilities in the same zone are affected, remaining infrastructure may not have sufficient capacity to handle all workloads. Data centers, including redundant connections for power, water, telecommunications, and internet connectivity to maintain operations during emergencies. Security measures such as guards, fencing, surveillance, and alarms are designed primarily to prevent unauthorized entry rather than defend against military attacks. Chappell noted that the incident demonstrates that cloud computing services ultimately depend on physical facilities that remain vulnerable to disaster and conflict. So, yeah, it's super interesting that data centers will, I think, become more and more a target in kinetic combat in conflicts, especially as more of the decision making is shifted to AI, and that becomes like a driving force of the military operations. They're clearly going to be a target for these folks.
Yeah, that's another thing that happened last week too, was I don't know if we're going to get to that or not, but we'll just mention from a political perspective, there's a lot of movement that's been occurring in some of these areas, and the use of AI in warfare is another one. And to be frank, it's kind of odd, but if AI was to pit itself against itself, data centers is probably the things it would go after.
Totally. And the one thing that made me nervous, I saw a post maybe on Reddit somewhere, and it was saying that like they were doing all these simulations with AI and in warfare, and the AI kept going to the nuclear option.
Yeah, I mean, look, Chris, I'm going to tell you one thing that it resonates with me every day now, more and more and more. All these futuristic movies about advanced artificial intelligence and whatnot, and I'm talking everything from your future cyberpunk to your Terminators to, you know, any sort of future sci-fi and that kind of stuff. It either goes one of two ways. It's either we get the technology and at basic level minimum income for everybody. People have flying cars and, you know, the world is so disparately separated that it's just, you know, ultra wealthy and ultra poverty, right? That's one option.
Elysium.
The other option, Elysium, exactly. Yeah, that's actually what I'm thinking of. Yeah. The other option that comes out of this is computers determine that the best threat to humans is humans themselves and therefore make the decision to cease, get rid of the humans.
Yeah.
And that's your Terminator, your Matrix, and all those different, you know, franchises. And it's kind of like, where is the Jetsons future? That's what I want.
I really like the original Star Trek. Yeah.
I want the Jetsons future where it's like, hey, everything's automated. You can get dressed in 0.2 seconds, a fresh haircut every day, robots cooking food all around for you, that kind of stuff. And your biggest problem is your nagging boss at work where you're just building sprockets to power the AI. And I'm like, where is that? Where's that future? I want that version of the AI future where, you know, there's a funny joke that was kind of told, I think, when AI started image generation, Chris, and it was kind of like, you know, I was promised a future where AI would do my laundry and my cooking so I could focus on painting, yes. Not AI doing painting so I could focus on laundry and cooking.
Yeah. Oh, man. It's hard to keep the sense of optimism going, especially in light of what's happening.
Yeah.
But we must persist. We must go on.
Agreed.
Next up, cyber activity linked to Iran and pro-Iranian actors has intensified following a joint U.S.-Israel military strike on Iran that killed Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei and several other government officials. Security researchers report a broad wave of cyber operations, including distributed denial-of-service attacks, network intrusions, and attempts to disrupt critical infrastructure. Analysts from organizations such as Checkpoint Research, Flashpoint, Palo Alto Networks, Unit 42, and Cisco Talos indicate that these cyber operations are intended to create economic disruption, reputational damage, and in some cases, physical consequences. The United States government expects additional cyber retaliation from groups affiliated with Iranian state organizations, such as the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and the Ministry of Intelligence and Security, as well as from hacktivist groups sympathetic to Iran. One coordinated campaign identified by researchers is the hashtag #OpIsrael operation carried out by a coalition of pro-Iranian and pro-Russian cyber actors. The campaign focuses on targeting critical infrastructure and stealing sensitive data. Researchers described Iran's cyber ecosystem as supporting several objectives simultaneously: espionage to gather intelligence and establish footholds within targeted networks, disruptive activities such as DDoS attacks, pseudo-ransomware and data wiping malware designed to impose operational costs, and information operations that amplify the impact of attacks through coordinated messaging and data leaks. Analysts say these activities represent a broader strategy to apply economic pressure globally in response to military setbacks. Several individual threat groups have already conducted operations linked to this escalation. Cotton Sandstorm, an Iranian threat actor associated with the IRGC, revived a previously inactive persona called Al-Tufan Team and has claimed attacks against targets in Bahrain, a country that hosts U.S. military bases. Another group known as the FAD team conducted a global SQL injection campaign that reportedly exposed personal identifiable information from multiple organizations. SQL injection still a thing?
Yeah, of course it is. Absolutely.
Wild, man. Clean your inputs. Flashpoint reported that victims included a virtual U.S. Air Force group and educational institution in France, India, and Vietnam. The same group also claimed to compromise network monitoring dashboards associated with firewall devices in Saudi Arabia and conducted disruptive attacks against regional organizations, including the Bahrainian News Agency and Qatari energy and media entities. Other operations have focused on Israel and its regional partners. Unit 42 reported that the hacktivist persona Handala Hack, which researchers linked to Iran's Ministry of Intelligence and Security, conducted attacks involving data exfiltration against Israeli political and defense organizations. The group claimed to compromise an Israeli energy exploration company and Jordan's fuel system and previously targeted Israeli healthcare institutions to increase domestic pressure. Meanwhile, a coalition known as the Cyber Islamic Resistance coordinated DDoS attacks, website defacements, and data wiping operations against Israel and Western infrastructure, including claims that it compromised an Israeli drone defense system and payment infrastructure. Support for these cyber operations also appears to extend beyond Iran itself. Pro-Palestinian group Dark Storm Team has claimed DDoS attacks against Israeli websites, including a bank, while pro-Russian hacktivist groups such as Cardinal and Known Name 057 have announced operations against the Israeli government, telecom, and defense-related targets. Researchers warn that the conflict is likely to generate a prolonged wave of hybrid cyber and physical threats. Security teams are being advised to increase monitoring, enforce security controls such as multi-factor authentication, and assess potential risks from partners or third-party organizations in the Middle East that may provide pathways into broader corporate networks. So yeah, man, the world is not in a good spot right now, and everything's going to get more dangerous, and we have to get more resilient.
Well, that sums up the podcast, actually.
Yeah. I know. I feel like we just keep ratcheting it up, though. You know, like,
This shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone. I think the moment any sort of conflict, I mean, we had this happen years ago with Ukraine. The moment any sort of conflict spins up anywhere in the world, folks, hopefully it doesn't surprise any of our listeners, but there's always now a cyber component to it. The kinetic action is fairly predictable. The cyber component is the one that, you know, could be anything from taking lights out, shutting down power plants, to hacking, you know, the disruption attacks against partners, affiliates. I mean, all kinds of potential options here. And I think it's just something, Chris, that's just going to become part of the narrative. I'm not saying we're desensitized to it, because we shouldn't be, but I think it's just going to become part of the narrative. And I'm sure that, you know, military apparatuses look at it this way too, which is, okay, you know, we're launching an attack on a particular thing. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, I'm pretty sure the United States confirmed that cyber capabilities were part of the attack or kidnapping, I don't know, invasion, Venezuela, whatever you want to call it. I'm pretty sure that, you know, it was mentioned specifically there was a cyber component to that. I think we talked about it as well. Mm-hmm.
I think they might have shut some lights off or something like that.
Yeah, and it's just going to become a part of it, you know, and it's mentioned in here. This actually refers back to what we talked about, right? Where there was an attack on AWS in the UAE, and then also there was an attack, a cyber attack on Saudi Arabia's Aramco facility at Ras Tanura. And I think it's just some of those things that we are just going to be part of the flow now. And I'm not trying, for anyone who's listening, I'm not trying to downplay it or hand wave it away, but unfortunately, I think we're going to start to see a larger percentage of cyber attacks versus kinetic actions. And that may be, you know, not 8% to 9% or something, which in itself can be pretty significant and whatnot. But, you know, it's just one of those things where I think we're going to continue to see growth of it. And the other thing I'll add to this, Chris, and I'm not a former military intel analyst or anything like that. I don't have any insight here, but I'm just going to say one thing to the mix, which is, it seems to me like Iran pretty much, you know, granted they had a ton of warning that this was going to happen, but the other side of it too is, I wouldn't be surprised if they had these targets picked out and locked in probably much before that. And yeah. That's the other thing to note for folks, is the targeting, kind of how do we disrupt things, is also changing, because it's like, let's go for data centers. Let's go for American associated things if the US is involved. You know, let's go after Amazon. Let's go after Google. Let's go after Meta. Let's go after, you know, various areas. And that's going to be the other consideration, is how do we notify private industry ahead of time that something's about to happen, right? And you know, God forbid, I would never want to hear this story, but I'd never want to hear the story that a bunch of network engineers lost their life because a data center got bombed as a retaliatory effect for a thing that happened all the way over there versus here. And it's just some of these situations where it kind of changes the approach and the tempo of warfare.
And it makes you really question, like, I know in the last year or so, we've seen a lot of Chinese APTs getting persistence on edge network devices, you know, for what they term long-term destructive behavior. And I think there's, like, a lot of seeds are being planted all over by all kinds of nation state actors, so that if they ever do want to push the big button, they can take down networks and cause lots of damage.
Absolutely. And we can't discount it. We can't discount it from the operations. Now, I don't think anybody does. I hope no one does, but we definitely have to include it in our discussions and assessments now.
All right. So this next one I picked strictly because of the name. I feel like there's a children's book in this one. The India-linked advanced persistent threat group known as Sloppy Lemming has significantly increased its cyber operations over the past year, targeting organizations in Pakistan, Bangladesh, and other parts of South and Southeast Asia. According to research from cybersecurity firm Arctic Wolf, the group focuses on nuclear regulatory bodies, defense contractors, logistics providers, and telecommunications organizations. Analysts report that the threat actor has evolved its technical capabilities, moving away from widely available red team tools such as Cobalt Strike and Havoc C2 towards custom-developed malware written in the Rust programming language. At the same time, the group has expanded its command and control infrastructure using Cloudflare's serverless workers platform, increasing its operational infrastructure from 13 domains a year ago to at least 112 domains. Researchers view this development as part of a broader increase in cyber espionage activity across South Asia. Threat intelligence analysts note that the region has seen a growing number of nation-aligned cyber groups conducting intelligence gathering and network compromise operations. According to Arctic Wolf's threat intelligence team, cyber operations in the region have become more frequent and more specialized. Raising geopolitical tensions between India and Pakistan have contributed to this activity, particularly following several recent military and security incidents across the region. These tensions include Pakistan's claim that India may be preparing military action and recent cross-border operations linked to militant activity. The Sloppy Lemming group primarily relies on phishing and credential theft to gain access to target networks rather than exploiting zero-day vulnerabilities. Arctic Wolf identified two primary attack chains used by this group. One involves sending victims a PDF document designed to redirect them to a malicious payload, while the second uses macro-enabled Excel documents that deliver a Rust-based keylogger. Researchers also link Sloppy Lemming to other track threat clusters such as Outrider Tiger and Phishing Elephant. Additional research from Proofpoint identifies several India-aligned threat groups, including TA397, also known as Bitter, which shares operational overlap with Sloppy Lemming. Other groups such as TA399, known as Sidewinder, and TA395, called Frantic Tiger, sometimes share phishing themes, infrastructure, or compromised accounts, suggesting some level of coordination or shared resources. While these groups may collaborate or share infrastructure, analysts emphasize that not all India Nexus threat actors are part of the same organization. Kaspersky researchers track several separate groups operating in the region, including Phishing Elephant, Dropping Elephant, and Mysterious Elephant.
Ooh.
These groups appear to operate independently with distinct targets and operational methods. For example, Mysterious Elephant primarily targets diplomatic, military, and defense institutions in Pakistan and Bangladesh, while Sloppy Lemming and Phishing Elephant focus more heavily on nuclear oversight bodies and infrastructure providers. Researchers also observe increased use of modern programming languages such as Rust and cloud-hosted infrastructure to make malware analysis more difficult and to obscure command and control operations. Despite adopting more advanced tools and infrastructure, Sloppy Lemming has demonstrated inconsistent operational security practices. Investigators discovered that some of the group's command and control servers were misconfigured with open directories, allowing researchers to access part of the attacker infrastructure. This mixture of growing technical sophistication and operational mistakes is reflected in the group's name. Analysts note that while the threat actor has improved its tooling and infrastructure, its operational discipline still falls short of the more advanced cyber espionage groups associated with other major nation state programs. So that's kind of fascinating. And also terrifying what's going on in this region as well. So more things to keep you up at night.
Yeah, I mean, why not? We need more of those, right? We absolutely need more of those. This is another interesting situation. Just for anyone who's listening and is curious here, if I'm not mistaken, we're talking about an India Nexus threat actor in this case. And the Tiger reference, if I'm not mistaken, is CrowdStrike, for anyone who's doing kind of the mental correlation between the two. And I believe the elephant is Kaspersky, if I'm not mistaken here. And I'm going through and I think... the Mysterious Elephant actually came about in October. That's when Kaspersky released that thing. So for anyone who's kind of doing the correlation here, Sloppy Lemming, I think appears to be an Arctic wolf name, I think.
Mm. Yeah, I think so. I have no idea how a lemming is associated with India, but
this one is, and I'm actually like off the side researching, trying to figure out how this works and whatnot as to where they came from. It might not be associated with Arctic wolf. I'm not sure, but Sidewinder APT is another one I see mentioned quite often as well. And I think a lot of this is mentioned in here. So for anyone who's kind of curious about like, what, another thing I need to track, another animal I need to be aware of? No, this is just the same stuff, you know, people calling threat actors different things for marketing purposes, but it's actually a really solid article. Hat tip to the folks at Arctic Wolf. I mean, just look at the scroll bar off to the side, Chris. There's so much information here. It was really cool to see and really cool to read through for sure. And I kind of like really enjoyed digging through this. There's some awesome malware analysis inside of here, insight into how the piece of malware works. I will be the first person to probably hypothetically posit here that the adversary likely utilized AI to move to Rust. And that's kind of what saw the development of some of the custom-based malware there.
That's exactly what I thought when I read that too. It's like, oh, these guys are using AI to write their own tooling now.
Yeah, absolutely. And we might be wrong, Chris. I don't know, maybe, but I'm just throwing it out there and saying it's very possible that when they did make the move to Rust, you know, it's very, very possible that they did. That throws a little bit of uniqueness into the mix as well. It's not every day that we read sentences like a macro-enabled Excel document to deliver a Rust-based keylogger. And this one's pretty interesting. And the use of Rust programming language. And this is where we've got to be careful, Chris, as an industry, we've got to be careful about compliments and adjectives that we use when we describe threat actors. And I'm not taking a dig at Arctic Wolf whatsoever. I am not, you know, howling about this. But the one thing I will note is, you know, the use of Rust programming language represents a notable evolution. I'm glad they called it that because it is kind of a significant milestone. But I'm also happy that they didn't then lean on things like, oh, this is a level of sophistication. And I feel like one thing this article does a really good job of, and again, another hat tip to the Arctic Wolf folks, they recognize that this is likely an adversarial milestone movement, but it is not likely indicative of advanced sophistication. In fact, if I search for the word sophistication, I get nothing back. Instead, what it is the adversary's, you know, change programming languages. How hard is it to do these days? Not that difficult. And I do like the fact that, you know, if this was a few years ago, some of the things that we see in here would actually be, hey, this is a sophisticated threat actor. And now it's like, you know, what? Probably use some AI to get this done. What's even more interesting is the sectors that they're going after. Targeting and going after things such as, you know, defense organizations, energy utilities, telecom providers, and stuff like that. Is just, you know, a very interesting focus, if you will, for what they're going after. So I don't think we should be too surprised by this at all. It's definitely an expectation, I think, but it's certainly, you know, certainly not a, what's the word I'm looking for here? Certainly not like a surprise. You know, it's not like, oh my gosh, here we go, you know?
Yeah, yeah. All right. The last one I have for us, I picked because it harkens back to a conversation that I had with a woman from Enhance.io who was saying one of the areas they saw for growth for MSSPs in the coming year was going to be around securing physical building controlling software. And I thought, what a weird thing to make a prediction for. And sure enough, I'm starting to see it pop up in articles. So hats off to you. I can't remember a name off the top of my head or I call her out, but it's in our prediction episode from the end of the year there. So a cybersecurity researcher has reported a potentially serious vulnerability in Honeywell's IQ4 building management controller, though the vendor disputes both the severity and practical impact of the issue. The findings were published by, and I'm going to butcher this, Joko Kurstik, a researcher known for investigating building automation systems and identifying vulnerabilities in industrial and facility management technologies. According to Kurstik, the IQ4 controller exposes its web-based human-machine interface without authentication when running in its factory default configuration. If the system is not properly configured during setup and a user module is not enabled, a remote attacker who can reach the management's interface may be able to create an administrator account before legitimate operators establish their own credentials. Kirstick explained that such an action could allow attackers to lock legitimate administrators out of both local and web-based configuration interfaces. The researcher warned that the issue could affect organizations that rely on building automation systems, including schools, commercial buildings, and other facilities that use the IQ4 controller to manage operational infrastructure. Building management controllers are commonly used to regulate systems such as heating, cooling, lighting, and other environmental controls, making unauthorized access potentially disruptive. Honeywell acknowledged receiving the vulnerability disclosure in December of 2025, but stated that it does not plan to release a security patch. The company argues that the scenario described by the researcher can only occur during the installation phase of the product before it becomes operational. According to Honeywell, IQ4 devices are delivered unconfigured and are typically installed by trained technician. During the installation process, security protections are enabled as part of the device's setup. Honeywell also stated that the controllers are intended for on-premise deployment and should not be exposed directly to the internet. The company maintains that if the installation process is followed correctly, the device operates with a secure by default configuration and cannot control equipment until configuration is complete. Kirstick disputes Honeywell's assessment and claims the risk is greater than the vendor suggests. In his research, he identified approximately 7,500 instances of the IQ4 controller exposed to the public internet, with about 20% reportedly accessible without authentication. He also stated that in some real-world deployments, he was able to modify operational components even when a user account had not yet been created. According to the researcher, he was able to adjust lighting and temperature settings and even disable equipment such as boilers or chillers. While Security Week confirmed that many IQ4 interfaces are exposed online, it did not independently verify these operational control claims. A CVE identifier for the vulnerability is pending, and Kirstick has contacted the CERT Coordination Center at Carnegie Mellon University to assist with disclosure coordination. Researchers note that building automation systems are frequently targeted by attackers due to their potential to disrupt physical operations. So kind of fascinating. I had no idea this was such a big area of security, and I did recently read about how much efficiency these kind of systems can bring to buildings. So we're talking in like a 20% reduction in heating costs, which in like a large facility, you're talking $30,000, $40,000 a year. So it's there's definitely motivation to see this technology deployed. But again, you know, rolling things out quickly creates a lot of problems. And here we are, same story, different platform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Believe it or not, it's interesting. We're not here talking about a geopolitical event that's happening. We're actually talking about kind of a normal run-of-the-mill vulnerability. Oh my God.
Cyber-physical, goodness. Though. Cyber-physical.
the calmest thing we've got today, which is good. No, I actually don't have much to add here, Chris. I think you covered it in really, really good detail. There is a really interesting like article and blog post that kind of delves into this a little bit. Definitely recommend, you know, really, Chris, the big takeaway and insight I had for this was anyone who deals in this space, especially deals with these particular devices and whatnot, get up to par and just be aware of them. You know, perhaps the biggest takeaway is that the findings have been reported to Honeywell, but there's apparently not any patches available and whatnot, and that the product should not be exposed to the internet, which I have to follow the manufacturer's advice here and just say, don't expose this thing to the internet. So,
but how am I going to change the heat settings for my bed at home?
Yeah, I know, exactly. It's just, one of those things where like, unfortunately, the researcher disagrees and found that 7,500 internet exposed instances of the product and have estimated 20% can be accessed without authentication. Those are the statistics we did not need in this blog post. But nonetheless, here they are. And just, you know, folks, if you're listening to this and you have these devices in your environment, you protect these networks or you know someone who does, please just notify them. Like, take this thing offline if it's not supposed to be there. The vendor is recommending you don't put it online, so just don't. Yeah. I don't know the risk profile for actually putting one online, but let me say it the other way. If your company has determined that it must be online, then wrap defenses in front of it. But our advice here is to follow the manufacturer's instructions before anything else.
Yeah. Awesome. Matt, 300.
I can't believe it. We made it, man. Congrats to you, sir. 300 crits is more of a milestone for you. I think for me, it's about episode like 150 or maybe 140 or something like that.
But half of them.
I'm still super enthralled to be here. So thank you for bringing me on this journey for sure. And I don't know, man, here's to the next 300.
Yeah. And hopefully we get some more boring stories to cover next week.
I would love it if next week we could have a couple of like CVSs, maybe a couple compromised Python or JavaScript packages. Maybe a little old-fashioned vulnerability.
NPM poisoning. Yeah. Just give me something simple. No drones, please.
We don't want that. I don't know. Maybe we'll find some feel-good article. You know what I would love, Chris, is a coordinated global law enforcement takedown.
There we go. I'll try and find one next week. Maybe we can do a Schadenfreude episode and talk about everybody going to jail.
There we go. I like it. Awesome. Right. Well, take care, sir. Good seeing you.
Yeah. Take care.
Bye.
And that brings us to the end of another Intel Chat. You can support this show by sharing your favorite episodes with a friend or subscribing and giving us a rating or leaving a comment on your chosen podcast platform. If you want to be part of the conversation and access the intel we talk about in real time, you can join our community forum at community.limacharlie.io. Thanks for listening in, and we'll see you on the next one. The Cybersecurity Defenders podcast is hosted and produced by Christopher Luft. The show is co-produced and edited by Sam Blake with graphics by Amr Al-Khatib. Sponsored by Lima Charlie, scalable infrastructure for your security services. Visit limacharlie.io to get started for free.